Hello, listeners. We're here today with Josh Martin, co-host of Hollywood Hoops. I just referenced this, actually, on my podcast last week with Corey from Lakers Nation, talking about how Hollywood Hoops covers both the Clippers and the Lakers. The Clippers arm of that. Josh Martin is joining us here today. Josh, thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about Doc Rivers and the rest of the squad. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's my pleasure.
So before we get started, of course, what's your Twitter handle?
Twitter handle is at Josh Martin NBA.
Awesome. So I wanted to start with the big recent news. Doc Rivers being relieved of his GM duties / stepping away from his GM duties. So this is sort of loaded, but what's the downside? I can't
tell. The downside of Doc Rivers
Is there any bad... Is there anything bad about this?
I guess it depends on how you feel about Lawrence Frank. If you feel like he's ready to fully take control of the front office, if you feel like he's not still going to be beholden to what Doc Rivers does, because that's really what this comes down to, is that, you know, if Doc is not – Doc really hadn't been the most involved in the day-to-day of front office duties, as far as I understand. That's why he enlisted – Lawrence Frank. That's why they went out and hired a whole bunch of people last summer. That's why Jerry West was brought on this summer. It was essentially to allow Doc to sort of distance himself from the grunt work of the front office. And now he'll be focused solely on coaching. And I think that makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of coaching to be done with the Clippers. When you look at, they've got 9 new players. Chris Paul's gone. Blake Griffin is now their number one guy, and so they have to sort of sort out how they're going to play and how they're going to what their identity is going to be. So really, there's so much on Doc Rivers' plate just as a coach in any season, really, but especially this season, that it really made a lot of sense for that role to sort of be removed from his title so that he could focus on coaching and let and the day-to-day of that and trying to win in the here and now and let someone else or someone's else focus on sort of the long-term planning that goes with running a front office.
I agree, definitely. And that's sort of why I'm saying there doesn't seem to be a ton of downside with this move. Doc Rivers, I just think, can't fully do his coaching job. And over the last few years, it was a little bit easier to put the team on autopilot just because the core was so consistent. CP3, Blake, JJ, Austin, DeAndre. I mean, so much of the team was consistent from year to year that there weren't really new systems to add in the way that there are now with 9 new players. So I think that his sort of laissez-faire attitude about practice, for example, can't continue. He needs to have practices, I would hope. I think we've seen, too, you know, if you're splitting your time between coaching and GMship, he's been able to scrape by getting some really great minimums. But in a lot of ways, the Clippers cap situation was not super favorable. He traded away a lot of draft picks. He waived players like Jared Dudley that turned out to be worthwhile guys. It just really seems like this is a no-lose situation.
Yeah, I mean, they were already losing with Doc in the role that he was in. You mentioned Jared Dudley. They actually didn't just waive him. They traded him with a first-round pick to Milwaukee to get off of that contract. And Jared Dudley was good for the Bucks that year after. So there's been a lot of missteps. I think generally with Doc sort of serving in a personnel capacity, the Clippers really didn't focus on trying to develop from within. Obviously, they had a consistent core, but they never had great depth, which is part of what happens when you don't focus on developing players and building through the draft, trying to make something happen through the draft. And they always had holes to fill, particularly on the wing, which is another spot where, you know, if you actually commit to trying to draft players, trying to bring in new talent that way and develop guys, maybe a guy develops into a rotation player for you. Maybe he develops into a trade chip that you can use to get that other player that you need to fill that need. And I think, look, I you can understand where Doc Rivers was coming from in the sense that, you know, he's trying to win a championship. He came to L.A. to win a championship with this Clippers team, or with the team as it was with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin. And when you're trying to win with a team of that caliber, you're going to be focused not on trying to develop young players. There's not really room for that. You're trying to bring in guys who can help you win now, veteran guys who understand what it takes to win in the NBA, the types of habits you need, guys who are proven commodities. So that makes sense, certainly from a coaching perspective, but if you're management, you still have to have
your eye
a little bit further down the road. You have to have a sense of, well, you know, this guy's going to be up in X year, whatever. Well, how are we going to deal with that?
You have to get the Patrick McCaws.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to do the grunt work. And that's not something that Doc was focused on, because he, as a coach, was trying to win a championship. But that made it all the more important then for the Clippers then to have someone else who has a different purview, who has a different outlook and a different job, to then really take over that job of being the head of personnel, the head of the front office, and allow Doc to do what he does. Whether you think he's good at as a coach or not, there's some question there, but at the very least, he will be allowed to focus now on what his strengths supposedly are in the role.
Oh, man. Assuming that he's a good coach, we'll talk about that soon.
Mm-hmm.
I like Jerry West. I love Jerry West as the final wall you have to get through. The final, okay, well, you know, if you trade Klay Thompson for Kevin Love, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make this macro decision. I like him as a macro decision maker. And Lawrence Frank, I think that there's a higher degree of success than just, you know, bringing in some random guy off the street, based on the idea that if he says, look, we need a guy to take care of this, to do analytics on draft prospects, I think that Ballmer's going to pay for that guy. Mm-hmm. And so much of being a good GM, I feel like, is your people. And that's going to be financed adequately. The front office, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Clippers certainly have a lot of people. They have one of the larger front office staffs in the entire league now, after just, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, really having one of the leaner staffs. And part of that was Ballmer essentially giving a blank check to Doc Rivers and then to Lawrence Frank to go out and hire people. You know, I was speaking to someone recently, though, because there's some skepticism about really how effective that spending strategy is. Someone in the know was telling me recently he thinks that he thought at least that Doc Rivers was going to turn Steve Ballmer into a millionaire. As in, obviously, Steve Ballmer has many, many billions, but that with the way that the Clippers were spending on front office people, the way that they pay their assistant coaches, the way they pay people in their front office, they pay them very well. But the question is whether they would get comparable results, or the results that sort of expense would warrant. So, look, we'll find out. At least their heads and their intentions, I believe, are in the right place now, where they're trying to build an organization that can sustain success for years to come, regardless of who's on the team. Because at the end of the day, you know, as much as the NBA is a stars league and you have to have stars to win, stars get old. They become not stars anymore. And
They
punch people and break their hands, whether that's Blake Griffin or Danilo Gallinari, really just insert Clipper here. So, you know, I think they're moving in the right direction in that sense, but there's still some organization to be done within the Clippers. There's still some things to be sorted out, both on the court and off the court. And we'll have to see, realistically, if Doc is in this for the long haul and if the Clippers would have him in the long haul. Because he has 2 years left on his contract, and typically coaches who plan to stick around this time in their contracts are starting to wonder what comes next. Do I get an extension, or is it time to see what else is out there?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting, kind of regrettable but predictable, that so much of this is sort of a consequence of the still lingering presence of the whole Sterling thing. So what I mean is, you know, Doc took over sort of as martial law, right? He was put in this situation where there really needed to be basically a Cheeto, right? Because that's what the situation dictated, and that took a while to resolve itself. The complete lack of front office stability and resources, you're building from ground zero, and that's sort of a result of the cheap spending, right, of Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lack of draft assets, of history of good draft picks, the Clippers curse stuff that I think still lingers around and still lingered around Lob City. I feel like, the NBA as a whole feels differently about this team if it wasn't a Clippers team. So I think the Clippers, what I would say about all that seemingly indiscriminate spending by Steve Ballmer is that really you have to give the Clippers a lot of credit and Steve Ballmer a lot of credit for the speed at which they're basically becoming a good franchise.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you can't fault them there. They're really focused, I think, on the right things now. And now that there's an understanding that you can't just have one guy who's calling all the shots, that you need different people calling the shots for different jobs and different roles. I think that'll allow things over time to sort of settle in, but it still is going to take time for everyone to get used to this new arrangement, because at the end of the day, it's still the same people at the top. It's still Doc Rivers reporting to Steve Ballmer as coach. It's still Lawrence Frank now reporting not to Doc Rivers, obviously, but he's reporting to Steve Ballmer directly as well. So I think that may take some time. We'll see. But I think the processes are on track to become more effective over the long haul. And we'll see if it plays out on the court in the way that I'm sure the Clippers hope it will. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whether you have like the perfect process in place within your organization if the product that you put out isn't quality. If you're not putting out a good basketball team, then none of that stuff really matters. It just sounds nice when you put it in corporate speak.
Right. Yeah. And I've been sort of bearing the lead here. We've been touching on it, sort of coming back through and tapping it, this idea, this elephant in the room. This year, to me, really seems like the referendum on Doc Rivers as a head coach. I was thinking about how many free throws this team is probably going to take. DeAndre Jordan, 26th. Danilo, 21st. Blake Griffin, 13th. Lou Williams, 7th. And that's free throws per 36, right? That's intense. That's a lot of guys taking free throws. I think that, you know, by a significant margin, the Clippers are going to take more free throws than any other team, which means a whole lot. There's a whole lot of implications there, right? Especially when you have a super deep roster with weird eccentricities, right? You know, if there's fewer fast breaks, you can switch out the rotation more. You are putting guys in foul trouble. Can Doc Rivers respond to that? Can he figure out when you're supposed to put Blake at the five and Danilo at the four? Can he decide when you want, you know, Teodosic and when you want Lou Williams and when you want Austin Rivers and when you want Patrick Beverley? These decisions are critical. And I feel like if you look at a team like Boston, which was sort of similar in regards to, well, there was a lot of ones, a lot of twos, and a lot of bigs, not a lot of wings. And this was last year, not this year when they have 500 wings. But you had a guy at the helm who just knew what the right move was all the time with Brad Stevens. Doc Rivers, I feel like we're going to have tangible, very tangible in a way that we didn't before, evidence to say you're good or you're not good in terms of being an NBA coach in the modern era.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting year for him because he doesn't have Chris Paul around essentially calling a lot of the shots, in the sense that even though whatever you think of Doc Rivers as a coach or what he's been as a coach over the last 4 years with the Clippers is inextricably tied to the way Chris Paul has wanted to play and the way Chris Paul prefers to have, you know, who he prefers to have out there. Not that Chris Paul is, you know, designing rotations and coming up with all the plays and everything, but it's clear, it was clear, especially last year, that there was sort of a tension as far as the style of play was concerned, because you going into training camp last year and into the regular season, Doc Rivers talked about the importance of ball movement and player movement and really sharing and, you know, guys being multi-positional and playing more of a modern style. But then as the season wore on, all that sort of went out the window. And from time to time, Doc would say, you know, after a game or before a game, whenever, he'd say, he'd sort of lament the lack of ball movement and the lack of that sort of sharing mentality. And you ask him, well, why is it that your team isn't doing that? Or what else can you do to fix that? And he just kind of throw his hands up and do the usual, I don't know, shtick, right? Which really, when you think about it, was cover, you know, in 20, you know, hindsight being what it is, was that was all really cover in my mind for that Chris Paul wanted to play a certain style, and it was different from what Doc wanted. But considering that Chris was the best player on the team, Chris is the one that he relied on, he sort of had to abdicate to what Chris wanted. Chris isn't there anymore now. So if the Clippers want to move the ball around more, if they want to play more of a wide open style, then they can do that. They don't have a point guard now who's keen to have the ball in his hands, dribble around for, 15, 16 seconds and then pass it or take a shot. Now that they can spread it around a little bit, they have more guys on the roster who are playmakers, whether that's Blake or Danilo Gallinari, Milos Teodosic, Alou Williams coming off the bench, Austin Rivers. There's just a greater variety of guys who can do different things with the ball. And so you can compare that to where the Clippers were in previous years, where everyone sort of had a very specific regimented role that they had to fill. And the machinery worked great. When it was like, when they were firing on all cylinders, when Chris had the ball and he had his feel for the court, and JJ's coming around a screen, and Blake is setting a screen for this guy, or Luke is setting a screen, and DeAndre is sort of doing some pick and roll. When you have everybody doing their specific jobs well, think of it like a football team, then it works great. They scored with ease, but there was still a lot of effort that went into that. Whereas I think now, with guys ideally being able to do different things and fill different roles in different ways, you have a more versatile team. That should allow Doc Rivers to try some different lineups, to go more with Blake at the five, to play smaller, to play bigger, to play whatever style works. He should have more latitude to experiment. And, bringing this all back from our earlier discussion, since Doc now is not so consumed in any capacity really with being a front office person, he should, in theory, have more time and energy to devote to getting the most out of all the pieces now at his disposal.
All right. I feel pretty strongly about this. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a hot take, but it should be a rational argument.
I've got my oven mitts on, Chris. Throw it out.
Perfect. Right. You should put on another pair over those oven mitts. I think this is all Doc Rivers' fault. Chris Paul was oft injured, didn't play 48 minutes a game. Mm. Here's the thing that makes me super skeptical about this, and the idea that Chris Paul dictated the play constantly. Mm-hmm. You look at how they used their bench minutes. They decided, and by they, I mean Doc, decided to continue bringing Crawford back, inefficient one-on-one score type of guy, to be the lead score, sort of the guy driving this weird engine, trying to drive all five players who didn't really synchronize really well offensively, and then running the bench offense through Crawford. Wouldn't it be great if Blake Griffin had 4 or 5 years of experience running the pick and rolls, right? Running everything, running the system on the bench units, kicking it out to guys like Austin Rivers to shoot threes. But I think the fact that he kept deciding to run offenses through Crawford, even as he aged, was just myopic and sort of inexcusable, because he could have been developing these talents that Griffin was clearly bursting at the seams with, but which were sort of sublimated when he was on the court with, DeAndre Jordan, right? Didn't space the floor next to him, and against Chris Paul, who was really going to set the flow. So why didn't he stagger? Why didn't he get rid of Crawford? Why didn't he put shooters around Blake Griffin? Why didn't he push that boundary while Chris Paul wasn't there? So just removing the Chris Paul element, we've seen that, right? He's been injured. There are 12 minutes a game that he sits. And we saw what happens. It was Doc Rivers doing Doc Rivers stuff.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're not wrong. I'm not saying that Doc isn't still responsible. At the end of the day, he's still the head coach. So it's his job to get the players to buy in to what he thinks they should be doing. And it's his job to direct them. It's his job to set rotations. What I will say in defense, at least last season, with the way that the second unit operated, and this was sort of goes hand in hand with how they had an amazing start and it kind of went downhill and they never really recaptured. But one of those things was the way the second unit played. Their second unit was actually very good for a large chunk.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Because it wasn't just Jamal trying to score. They had essentially a three-headed monster of guys who could make plays off the dribble with Jamal, Raymond Felton, and Austin Rivers. They had Maurice Spates, who could space the floor. He could do some nice things for them, even on the defensive end. He was one of the leading charge takers in the league. And then for a while, they had Wesley Johnson playing the four with that group. Wes got hurt early in the season, was never really effective after that. You saw Raymond Felton got banged up a ton because Chris Paul got injured, and so Ray had to play a ton of minutes. And, you know, he's a guy who's really a bowling ball out there, bouncing into guys and off of guys, and that took its toll very early on. So the depth that they seemed to have early in the season crumbled a bit when really the top of their roster got banged up. So, I don't blame them for doing what they did with Jamal, but you're right. It's Jamal was sort of past that point where you could rely on him to get you double figures every night. Now, if every other night, maybe he can get you 10 plus, maybe every fifth to seventh night, he might really explode and have one of those Jamal type games. But if that guy is going to be such an integral part of your team, you need someone in that role who is going to be more consistent from night to night, whatever you think of his abilities in any given moment.
It seems like there was definitely a period there where year after year, the very best five-man lineup in the league was the Clippers starting five,
mm-hmm.
right? There was at least 3 years in a row where it was number two or number one,
mm-hmm.
maybe at worst number five. There are these basically 14 minutes every year that you would lose a game in, right? Because if you have the most effective starting five, then if you have even acceptable bench minutes that aren't run with Glenn Davis and Hedo Turkoglu, then you should be able to make that work.
Right.
I guess what I'm saying is the fact that things worked out with this Mo Spates, Raymond Felton, Crawford experiment at first mm-hmm. is sort of a flash in the pan, and it went away because it was a flash in the pan. But if you had a strategy and you had been staggering for the last 4 or 5 years and had built up that sort of Spursian cohesiveness, I know where the ball's going because I played with you for the last 5 years, and the way that mm-hmm. a lot of good coaches like Dwayne Casey builds it around Kyle Lowry, the bench unit is built mm-hmm. around LeBron James and shooters for the Cavaliers. That's right. A really effective strategy. And year after year, Blake Griffin could have done that and built up the cohesion so that by the fourth year, it would be even its best because you had guys like Mo Spates spreading the floor, shooting from deep. Raymond mm-hmm. Felton, Austin Rivers had his best 3-point shooting year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's three guys out there with Blake Griffin being the fourth as mm-hmm. a hyper elite pick and roll ball handler.
Right.
95th percentile year after year.
Well, part of I see where you're coming from, Chris, and there's a couple important points to consider on why they didn't do that or why it hasn't really been a big thing that the Clippers have focused on. Number one is that Blake has just not been that healthy from year to year. You know, last year he missed 21 games. The year before that, he missed 47 games. The year before that, he missed 15 games during the regular season. And that's not including, obviously, the injuries he's had in the playoffs as well. So it's hard to build up a second unit and around Blake and sort of rely on him to carry that unit if he's not going to be there consistently, if you can't count on him to be healthy. The other main point, this, again, like everything else today, goes back to Doc, the GM, is that he was the one stocking and restocking the bench. And every year, it was essentially a brand new group that they bring in around Jamal Crawford and, to a lesser extent, Austin Rivers. And so when you're shuffling new players in and out of your bench every year, sure, at some point you can build up a certain level of cohesion, but it's hard to have that second nature thing that the Spurs might have or the Raptors might have, where those teams have essentially had the cores of their second units together for multiple years. The Clippers have not had that. They've not had a consistent backup point guard. That's a position they've really struggled with. They've not had consistent play on the wings. That's been another huge issue for them in recent years. And so when you don't have that consistency, when you don't have that predictability of who's going to be there, then it's really hard to replicate those other great teams that do great things with their second units, because it's just too many new faces all the time. And you have to spend so much time with guys getting used to each other. And guess what? If you're not practicing because the NBA schedule is what it is, or because you're Doc Rivers and you're trying to cater to your older veterans, guys who really don't want to practice or are trying to preserve their bodies, then you're going to have that issue just sort of compounds itself, because then you wind up with guys who don't really know each other, who don't really trust each other out there, and that's when things really fall apart and have fallen apart for the Clippers, injuries aside.
Yeah, my problem with that is if your aspirations are championship or bust, you have to build the optimal system for the talent that you have, and that means you're staggering Chris Paul and Blake Griffin. There's no way of getting around that. That is how you do it. It's almost inarguable. Well,
the counter is the same counter that Scott Brooks might have used in Oklahoma City when he had Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, and that is that your best units, your best chance of really beating up on your opponent is when you have both of those guys out there.
Yeah, but do you buy that?
I mean, it's true that the best lineups would have both and not just one or the other. So there's something to that. But I do believe that it's important when you have multiple stars that you not only use them well together, but you use them well apart, that they support each other because they're able to operate independently and lead five-man units independent of one another. It's just, you know, these are difficult coaching decisions. Part of me would tend to give the coaches the benefit of the doubt because they're the ones who are around their players every day. They're digging into these things, and it's not like they're not, for the most part, they are aware of this data. It's just a matter of how do you operationalize it, and maybe they don't always do it that effectively. But look, in any case, that idea of whether the Clippers should or shouldn't have staggered Chris Paul and Blake Griffin is now irrelevant. Like, Chris Paul's not here. Blake Griffin is your star.
Danilo Gallinari,
in essence, is your second guy. You would think he's certainly your best scorer. So now you have two guys in that sense who are, you could argue, play the same position or should play the same position at power forward. Or maybe if you move Blake to the five more often, then you have Gallo at the four. But then what does that do to DeAndre? So you open up a whole new set of problems. But in any case,
right, and that's why this year's a referendum, I think.
Right, exactly. So we could go over and over again, like relitigating what the Clippers did wrong with Chris Paul, what they did right with him, what he did right and what he did wrong. But that's all done. That's all gone. The Clippers are moving forward with the group they have, and they're going to have a lot to figure out with that group. And it doesn't really matter. You know, I'm sure people are going to ask about Chris Paul during the season, especially when the Clippers play the Rockets, but the Clippers certainly can't proceed as if it's the same old song and dance. They can't proceed, you know, wondering, you know, well, what could we have done differently in the past? They just have to move forward with the guys they have and figure out a way to win with those guys they now have on their roster.
Well, so I guess looking back on the past, it's sort of in hopes of predicting whether or not Doc Rivers is going to have success in this referendum, in this sort of test year, to figure out whether he was the issue or whether Chris Paul's the issue, but really to just get to the bottom of whether or not he's effective as a head coach. I would think that if the Clippers don't make the playoffs, he might get fired. I'm not sure, but I feel like that's definitely in the cards as a possibility. I feel like that's the type of macro decisions Jerry West, if he sees this type of issue, I think he's going to be a little bit like Travis Schlenk, you know, for the Warriors. He's going to be like, okay, let's bite the bullet here. Doc Rivers isn't the guy. So rather than talking about or trying to figure out based on the symptoms, I think that now you have an even more complex guard plus Griffin. Chris Paul is such a versatile player offensively and defensively that, yeah, you can definitely make the argument that that's always going to work. You throw DeAndre in the mix, it's a little bit more complicated, but at least it's simple enough that Chris Paul plus almost any star is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But now you have this point guard situation where if you were to put Patrick Beverley in his defense, in, like, I guess, determination, Milos Teodosic in his playmaking, and then Lou Williams in his mid-range shooting and scoring into a blender, you get Chris Paul. And I think that watching how Doc Rivers decides who's going to be the primary initiator next to Griffin, or the secondary initiator, I don't really know, who's going to play next to Griffin in what situations, that's going to be very telling.
Yeah, and it's going to be critical to how this team organizes itself, because you figure they're going to orient their efforts almost primarily around Blake and his talents and try to highlight him and bring in players that fit well with him and help to make him better as well. Doc's going to have some interesting options. I think Patrick Beverley, you know, you talk about him defensively. I think he's better defensively than Chris Paul. I think he's more consistent defensively than Chris Paul. He's more of an instigator. He brings a different attitude to it. Obviously, Chris can be plenty of a pest himself, but Pat Beverley is a guy that I think other players in the league legitimately might be afraid of actually trying to play against because he's so physical, because he just doesn't give a darn. Like, he will go out
there. He'll injure you.
he will put you, his body in harm's way, and he'll put your body in harm's way as well. So, but he's also a guy who's a very good 3-point shooter. You know, last season he shot 38.2%, year before that 40%. So don't just think that he's just a straight up bulldog defensively. He's also a very good offensive player. He's not obviously a wizard with the ball like Chris Paul, but he can be effective in that regard. And if you pair him with Teodosic, who is known as perhaps one of the best passers on planet Earth, if not the best passer on planet Earth, I think that could be a lot of fun. Although defensively, there are concerns about what Milos brings to the table, that he's always been an apathetic defender in Europe. He's never really cared that much about that end, but he's so good offensively with what he can do as a passer and as a shooter. He's a high percentage shooter from outside. I think that will be a sort of an interesting option. And considering that Milos and Beverley have played together before, at the very least, they know each other's tendencies, and maybe there's something there, some sort of chemistry that Doc can work off of. But those two guys can shoot. Lou Williams can shoot. Austin Rivers can shoot. So at the very least, when you're looking at the Clippers guards, they can all shoot. They can all make plays to some extent. You know, defensively, obviously you look at Beverley and Austin Rivers as the better defensively of those four guys, whereas Lou Will and Milos are definitely more offensive-minded, to say the least. But I think it's a mix that can allow the Clippers to do some interesting things. I think they can play a lot of three-guard lineups. They can go smaller with that group and really experiment and see what they have. And, you know, I doubt that we'll see much of rookies in Sindarius Thornwell and Juwan Evans this season. But, you know, who knows? Maybe Doc Rivers feels more of an impetus now to give minutes to young guys because his team isn't quite championship caliber. I think it's still very much playoff caliber, but maybe there's some more leeway now to give the young guys some more run at the NBA level rather than stashing them in Ontario with the Caliente Clippers.
Yeah. You know, I actually think that DeAndre Liggins might end up playing a lot of minutes, particularly because I think that he can credibly play the wing defensively, at least. Offensively, he's not going to, you know, light the world on fire, but I think he's a credible defender at the three. And I feel like one of the big decisions that Doc Rivers is going to have to put up or shut up with and make the right decision with is, when are you in a situation where the starters are so lethal that you just can't have Teodosic out there? Because I think that there's something really interesting with Patrick Beverley and with Teodosic next to each other in the backcourt. You know, most teams, put aside the Warriors, right? Put aside maybe on a nice day the Celtics, put aside the Cavaliers of old, you're not going to have five supreme athletic threats on the floor at any given time. There's always going to be someone you can stash a wing on for 26 out of 30 NBA teams. So you put Milos on the worst offensive player, easy enough. I feel like that's not going to be true against elite players. Maybe that's where DeAndre Liggins comes in. But if you are in a situation where you need your guys to step up, I feel like Liggins needs to be the three, and you can sort of build something interesting around, like you said, Austin Rivers. I think he is a interesting defender, at least. Patrick Beverley's definitely a dog. And then you have DeAndre Jordan, defensive stalwart, right? Here's another strategy you could do. If that's the situation that you're in, as soon as, you know, Kevin Durant and Steph Curry are off the court, now you put in Gallinari at the four and Blake Griffin at the five, right? Like, now you're really trying to kill him in the minutes that Zaza Pachulia is playing.
I guess those are possibilities. But look, if you're the Clippers and you're relying on DeAndre Liggins to play major minutes at the three, to give you big time contributions on the wing, you're back to where you were the last 3, 4 years, 5 years, however many years, where you just didn't have good play on the wing. You didn't have reliable guys and a decent store of them who could, you know, play defense and maybe give you something offensively. You know, I think, you know, Liggins isn't bad in that regard. He's not a terrible offensive player, but he's certainly not a guy that other teams are going to see as a credible threat on that end. And that really will gum up your offense, especially in the playoffs, if you're going up against a smart defensive team that just says, well, we're just not going to defend this guy and we'll have someone else sort of play center field, or we'll double up on Blake or whatever. And that just sort of throws everything in the chaos as well. So I think it's very optimistic, I think, to think that DeAndre Liggins is going to be
right,
a difference maker on the wing. It's certainly optimistic at this point to think Wesley Johnson is going to be that guy, because he has not been that guy, and he's already been with the Clippers for a couple years now. So I think they're still in a tough spot on the wing, because unless you think that Danilo Gallinari is still well-suited to playing the three, then they still are without a real go-to at that wing position, which in today's NBA is just as important as it's ever been, if not more so, in part because although there is a scarcity of great wings in this league, the best teams in the league are the ones with those best wings. When you look at Cleveland with LeBron, and Golden State with Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant, Boston now with Gordon Hayward, and of course San Antonio with Kawhi Leonard. And I guess to some extent now you could say that you consider James Harden as a wing guard, whatever you want to say, Houston as well, and obviously Oklahoma City with Paul George next to Russell Westbrook. So if you're the Clippers and you want to compete with those teams, you at the very least, you need someone on the wing who can be a sort of a lockdown defender for some of those top wings, your KDs and your Paul Georges and your Kawhis and your LeBrons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But ideally, if you want to succeed long-term, going deep in the playoffs, you need someone who can be a credible two-way threat at that position, and the Clippers still don't really have that.
Yeah, it's especially interesting to me because it seems like the position that they have the most redundancy at is that primary initiating guard, and the particular guy who stands out as disposable happens to be the head coach's son, a head coach who originally or before was the ultimate decision maker with the roster, but now is not.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Doc Rivers' son might get traded for, say, Courtney Lee, someone like that?
I suppose it's possible. I wouldn't rule it out.
I mean, wouldn't that be the move? I mean, with this roster?
I mean, really the move, if you're the Clippers and you're really trying to upgrade your roster overall, it's not by trading Austin Rivers, it's by trading DeAndre Jordan and getting some value for him, because he can go into free agency next summer, and you know, who knows whether he decides to stay or if he goes somewhere else. And really, when you think about the modern NBA and trying to win, it's not that you don't need a defensive-minded center, but you do need one who can, you know, hit a free throw every once in a while, who has an offensive move that he can go to. And you need someone who, if he's going to be a guy who's supposed to dominate on the defensive end and dominate in very specific lanes, then he needs to do so more consistently than DeAndre Jordan has done. You could ask, if you watch the Clippers, you talk to Clippers fans, like, it's clear that DeAndre, as great as he can be when he really is into it, he just has not been into it fully from night to night. And who knows, maybe that changes now. If Chris Paul's not there, and he's not barking in DeAndre's ear every time he does something wrong. On the other hand, DeAndre is also the guy who, if there's something that goes wrong defensively, he's going to be the one barking at one of his other teammates saying, why did you do this? You should be doing that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he's still a very talented player. He's in his prime. He's 7 feet tall. He might be one of the greatest athletes we've ever seen at the center position, at least certainly among players of his size. You know, he's huge. He's got a very strong body, and he's a tremendous rebounder. He's an intimidating presence in the middle. I think there are still some teams out there that might value that. And really, for the Clippers, flipping him for, you know, maybe a slight downgrade at center, and for maybe another ring. You said Al Horford.
Blake Griffin can get a lot of those rebounds.
Sure, and that's part of the thing with it. The decrease in Blake's numbers, when you look at his field goal percentage, his rebounding numbers, the number of lobs that he gets, a lot of that is because DeAndre Jordan has been elevated in that role. So part of the problem that the Clippers had with Blake previously is that, you know, they're as great as Blake was at the different things he did, you know, he's a very good passer for a big man, but Chris Paul is still the guy you'd rather have running your offense. And he's a very good finisher and a very good rebounder, but DeAndre really is the best that you could ask for between him and Blake at rebounding and finishing. So Blake sort of had to carve out a different niche for himself where he was becoming more of a mid-range shooter and trying to space the floor and trying to fill in other gaps. Well, now obviously Chris is gone, so Blake can become a little bit more of a playmaker, but that still sort of leaves Blake pulled away from what made him great in the first place. And that was just his sheer physical ability to crash the glass, to dunk the ball, to be an imposing presence in the middle, to be someone who's just flying all over the place and finishing. And obviously, you know, the discussion of, you know, is Blake more than a dunker? That is dead and gone and buried, and we've gone through that. But when you're talking about what makes Blake Griffin great or what made Blake Griffin great, it was his ability to finish at and around the rim and to attack. And when you have DeAndre Jordan there, that's difficult when you're Blake, because DeAndre, he's not going to drift out to the perimeter and drag defenders with him. He's going to be near the basket. He's going to be either waiting for a lob or getting ready to offensive rebound or whatever. And that's going to clog up the lane because his defender is going to be there. And so Blake, if he's going to try to come charging down the middle, he's going to find a lot of resistance. So if you're the Clippers and you really want to maximize Blake Griffin's abilities and you're trying to build around him, you either have to institute him more now as the guy who's throwing lobs to DeAndre Jordan and have more of a big-to-big thing, or you got to really seriously consider trading DeAndre Jordan for other guys who might fit well around Blake, you know, shooters on the wing.
Right, playing him like LeBron with spacing everywhere.
Exactly, exactly. Because, you know, look, Blake Griffin is not LeBron.
He's sort of LeBron.
he's like a poor man's LeBron. Let's put it that way.
He's like an upper middle class LeBron.
Sure. However you want to look at it, like, he's not LeBron, but a lot of the things he does are similar to LeBron. He obviously is not as durable as LeBron, but what has always made LeBron great and still makes him great is that you just can't stop him. He can get to the rim at will with his strength and his speed and his quickness. Blake Griffin might not still have all those same physical attributes, but it's really hard to evaluate whether he can still get by guys and attack the rim because the opportunities have been so scarce for him in recent years.
All right. I got a couple more DeAndre trade ideas. I'm going to save the best one for last.
Sure.
Marc Gasol seems like a really natural fit. If they're going to be drawing all these free throws, I think that'll be particularly good. Give him time to get back. Not a lot of fast break possessions, right? And really, as a half-court defensive stalwart, that's going to be Marc Gasol's best role. And plus, now he's hucking up threes.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you're Memphis, why are you trading Marc Gasol for DeAndre Jordan? I think that's the question there.
Get off long-term money?
If you're the Grizzlies and you're trying to get off long-term money, then you're trying to get off Chandler Parsons. So I think if the Grizzlies would be more inclined to do a deal if they could trade Parsons for DeAndre Jordan, and if they were to throw in Marcus Ball, then
do it.
Get something else. But I don't think that Memphis is going to trade its franchise player in Marcus Gasol to bring back a guy in DeAndre Jordan who can just walk in a year.
I think they're maybe more rebuild inclined now, but, you know, thoughts.
Sure.
Another one, Steven Adams. I think it's interesting what they did with Paul George moving on from Oladipo's long-term contract.
Mm-hmm.
You put DeAndre, Paul George, and Russell Westbrook, it's like, if they all come back, this is awesome. If they all leave, fresh, clean slate.
Mm-hmm. I think that is more interesting to me, right? Because as you said, it's about, you can get Andre Roberson back, or I don't know, maybe, I don't know if the Thunder can trade him just yet. I guess they'll be able to.
They have that 1-3 who's good. I'm going to look him up.
Yeah, they have Alex Abrines is okay. He's sort of a 2-3.
Jeremy
but
Grant,
I don't know.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I don't know that the. I don't think the Thunder are going to be trying to trade Andre Robertson. They just re-signed him.
Yeah.
He's a guy who's an all defensive caliber guy. He was a terrible, terrible shooter, but what he does for them defensively is just next level. When you put him on a guy on some of the top wings in the league, you need someone who can defend at that position. I think Robertson will be better suited to the two than he was to the three. I think that's where they always wanted him in OKC. But if you're the Thunder, I don't know that swapping out Steven Adams for DeAndre Jordan makes you that much better, because Steven essentially does – he's very similar in the way he plays to what DeAndre does. You know, he's a pick-and-roll big. He'll get you offensive rebounds. He'll do the dirty work for you. He'll be a physical presence, especially on the defensive end, but he's not a guy you're going to try to dump the ball down to and get you points. I guess DeAndre is, you know, he's a better athlete, but Steven Adams is still a very good athlete. And if you're the Thunder, you know you have some cost certainty with him. You know he's going to be there. You know what his numbers look like. You have him under contract for four more seasons here, as opposed to DeAndre, who you could lose. So now, obviously, if you're willing to gamble that DeAndre makes you better enough alongside Russell and Paul George that you can really contend at a higher level, then maybe it's worth it. But I'm not so sure that if I'm the Thunder, I would go for that, especially when you factor in that while Steven Adams is not a great free throw shooter by any means, he can at least he hit better than 60% last season, whereas DeAndre still struggles to hit half of his.
Yeah, definitely makes some sense. My other idea is basically, so this works salary-wise. Mm-hmm. DeAndre, Austin Rivers, Patrick Beverley for Kyrie, Iman Shumpert, Channing Frye.
Mm. That's also interesting.
Channing Frye? Yeah, that helps with
I don't know that Channing Blake. Frye really helps. So the concern there is that it – you wind up, if you're the Cavs, with even more of a crunch up front. You said DeAndre, Austin Rivers, and Pat Beverley to Cleveland, and you said, okay, Iman Shumpert, Channing Frye, and Kyrie to the Clippers.
Yeah, that's got to look a little bit different. Yeah, Decker, I guess, needs to go to the Cavs.
It has to look different in the sense that, you know, the Cavs, they too currently have a guy who's a very good pick-and-roll finisher and rebounder and interior defender, Tristan Thompson. So you're not going to play – you're probably not going to play Tristan Thompson and DeAndre Jordan together. And you're trying to find minutes up front for all of these big guys, whether it's, you know, Kevin Love playing the four or the five, LeBron playing the four, sometimes playing the five. And the Cavs' problem isn't a lack of size and rebounding. It's a lack of really perimeter defenders, of two-way wings who they can trust to put on Kevin Durant or whoever else they have to face. That was their biggest problem in the finals, aside from all their miscues and just a lot of times just careless basketball, was they didn't have that one guy that you could stick on an opposing wing. So, look, if you're the Clippers and you can have a chance at any level to turn DeAndre Jordan into Kyrie Irving, you obviously do that 1,000 times out of 1,000. But I don't know that makes a lot of sense for the Cavs. I will say what
Patrick
would be
Beverley at point guard next to LeBron.
That might help. That might be good. But again, I don't think that really makes the Cavs or addresses the Cavs' needs as far as what they're looking for. It doesn't improve their situation on the wing. It just gives them more guards, which is fine, and they need guards, especially if you're trading Kyrie. But I don't think adding DeAndre to the roster makes them better. You'd probably have to find a third team for DeAndre to go to to make that work.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was just an idea I had because all the cool kids are trying to trying to trade Kyrie.
So what I would say would make sense – if there's one place, and if it fell into place like this, it might make sense is where if the Cavs traded Kyrie to the Suns for whatever package, and then the Clippers then also traded DeAndre to the Suns, as there was a rumor previously that they were going to try to do that, and maybe you get back Tyson Chandler and TJ Warren, or like some other wing player, maybe a cup, maybe a draft pick, maybe a another young player, something like that. Because at least in Tyson Chandler, you know, he's not DeAndre, but like he can shoot free throws, and he's a reliable, steady veteran. He's someone that his teammates really respect. He'd be a good locker room presence. The problem with him is he's older and he has injury issues, but I think that would make more sense if you're the Clippers and you could turn DeAndre Jordan into like a downgrade at center, along with, you know, another wing player and something along those lines. That might actually make them better this coming season.
Brooke Lopez, Luol Deng, and Brandon Ingram for DeAndre, Austin Rivers, and Wesley Johnson.
Oh, that is. I don't think the Lakers are going to part with Brandon Ingram under any circumstances, but especially not for that kind of return. I think they hold him in too high regard right now, and I don't blame them for that.
Oh God, that Luol Deng contract though.
Yeah, that's tough. It's tough, but I think the Luol Deng contract should be easier to get out from under than the Timofey Mozgov contract, just by virtue of. Luol Deng is a 3-4 in a league that very much values guys who can play those two positions, as opposed to a league where plotting centers have become essentially anathema.
Do you remember when that Magic trade board picture leaked?
Mm-hmm.
The hybrid forwards list. It's too bad that there's new management in Orlando. They could move Luol Deng, get Aaron Gordon probably.
Yeah,
messing around with the trade machine. It's productive. So we've pretty much touched on everything.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, big picture. Let's try two realities. One is where Blake Griffin is injured for most of the games, and one where he is healthy for most of the games. What do the Clippers look like in terms of wins, losses, playoff seeding?
If he misses most of the games, if he has an injury plagued season, and he's coming off an injury now, so it's certainly in the cards as a possibility, then I think the Clippers would struggle to make the playoffs, just plain simple. Any team that loses its best player for a significant amount of time is going to struggle to stay relevant, unless they have other guys or a number of other guys who are ready to step in. You know, the Warriors, when they missed Kevin Durant last season, they were fine because they still had Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green, the core of a team that had won a championship and won 73 games. The Clippers don't have that type of depth of talent at the top, because if you remove Blake Griffin from the equation, then your next best guy to be your central figure is Danilo Gallinari. And if Blake Griffin has had injury problems over the course of his career, then Danilo Gallinari has been absolutely plagued by every sort of ailment you could imagine, and has had even worse luck with his body than Blake has had with his. So, but if Blake is healthy for the majority of the season, I think you're looking at the Clippers as a potential 5 or 6 seed, because you look at the way that the West stacks up right now. I think roughly your top four is some combination of Golden State, San Antonio, Houston, and Oklahoma City. And then your next tier, you'd be looking at, you know, the Clippers in the mix with Minnesota, Denver, Portland, Utah. I think the Clippers have what it takes to maybe be the fifth or the sixth seed after that top four. But again, that really depends on health, and it depends on how this team is able to come together under Doc Rivers without Chris Paul, and how that more egalitarian style of play really works out for them, assuming that it comes to fruition.
The crazy thing is, being the sixth seed in the West is like a real accomplishment.
Yeah, and it's not going to matter much once you get to the playoffs, because you're going to be going up against a really, really great team in that first round anyway, so good luck. You know, could be Golden State if they only get in as the eighth seed, so good luck all around to folks out West. It's going to be a doozy.
Well, it's a good thing they're committing more to building through the draft now, because it is definitely something they could use, an injection of some young talent, a new take on this franchise. It'll be really interesting to see Blake Griffin, too, handling the ball more, doing some of the things that, you know, some of the periphery stats suggest that he's good at. But one thing that my guest Josh Martin is very good at is co-hosting Hollywood Hoops once again on Almighty Baller Radio. My guest today, Josh Martin, the co-host of Hollywood Hoops, I would say that he's the Blake Griffin of that podcast, whereas Chris Paul is, you know, obviously Eric Pincus.
Size-wise, right? I think that actually makes more sense.
Yeah, it definitely does. Well, one more time for the folks at home, and definitely you should go follow him regardless of whether you're a Clippers fan. You should follow him because he's full of wisdom. What's that Twitter handle?
At Josh Martin NBA.
Well, hey, thanks everyone out there for listening. Check out Hollywood Hoops. Thanks for listening to Almighty Ball and NBA Show, both available at almightyballer.com. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere else. We've got some big things in the works, so stay tuned for that. Check out all of our shows. Once again, almightyballer.com. Follow me at almightyballin, and follow the rest of this funky beat as we close out the outro. I'm going to cut it off right there.